Is America a gun nation? All right, let's look at the numbers, see what they reveal. Population of America is 342.7 million. Latest studies show there's roughly 500 million firearms in America. So that breaks down to approximately 135 firearms for every 100 people. 32% of U.S. adults personally own a gun, and there's at least one firearm in 46% of U.S. households. Almost every week we hear news about another mass shooting. Places which used to be a refuge from danger and violence are now targets for violent danger. How did this become the way of America? Is it as simple as the Second Amendment, how it's been utilized, or is there more behind all this? My first guest today with his new book reveals how more people and organizations have worked both separately and together to create today's gun culture in America. Part of the foundation of those efforts come from the ways that violence has long existed in America. His book is Ricochet, Guns, Greed, and the American Way of Violence. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist in the New York Times. Mike McIntyre, thanks for being here today, Mike.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Two websites, MikeMcIntyre.com, and of course, check out Mike's work in New York Times, nytimes.com/buy/MikeMcIntyre. But don't worry, we do have those links over at our webpage for you to hopefully make use of. I said this to you before we started. There's been countless books explaining what's been going on with guns. You nailed down the hows and the whys. What was your roadmap, and as you traveled it, did you find more than you bargained for?
Yeah, good question. I mean, so I've been covering gun issues to one degree or another as a journalist for about 40 years now, and I'm also a gun owner myself. I've had personal experience with it, and I think that over time I kind of felt like, you know, I had sort of a critical mass of information that I felt like I wanted to share, but in the course of putting the book together, I also learned a whole lot, which I, you know, wasn't completely aware of in the past. And one of the things I wanted to do with the book was kind of not just sort of chronicle, you know, the debates around the Second Amendment and the evolution of the National Rifle Association and you know, gun industry marketing, all of which are important. But I also kind of wanted to put it against a backdrop of our country's relationship, not just to firearms, but also just to violence in general. And the attempt here is not to kind of, you know, make a sort of a polemic about America being a violent country, because every country has its own history of violence and stuff to some degree, and unique to that country, and America is no different. But in the United States, it really is interesting, because, I mean, if you go back to the founding of the Republic, and even before, you know, violence plays an important role. You know, can't subjugate a continent without a degree of violence. You can't rebel against the crown without violence, or conduct a civil war, or the institution of slavery. And all these things together, I think, kind of mix into an understanding of gun culture in America, and particularly the revolution, which I think is worth noting today as we celebrate the 250th anniversary of the country. That was really a foundational experience and a positive one, whereas if you look in Europe, for instance, with their experience with, you know, wars and conflict, it was often in ways that they, you know, probably would prefer not to remember. But here, you know, it's really sort of the model of, you know, created the idea of the citizen soldier, kind of picking up the musket and going out to defend liberty. And I think that when you see gun industry marketing today that kind of is wrapped in the flag and heroism.
You know, much like we see with Donald Trump, what he's been trying to do now at the Smithsonian, trying to corrupt history with politics, has the historic role of firearms, like you're mentioning, and you certainly feature in your book, has that history been corrupted in order to make the scenarios and the scenes that we see and we have to live through today?
Well, I think that, I don't know if corrupt is the right word. I mean, I think that maybe it's been taken advantage of in some ways by commercial interests or political interests. You know, I think there's a lot to be proud of in terms of, you know, how we freed ourselves from a despotic ruler in the revolution, and the role that the citizens' militia played, and you know, guns are obviously integral to that. I do think, though, that over time, you know, certain self-interest has kind of used that whole imagery in ways that are very, you know, for political and ideological and commercial gain, to make guns sort of a cultural identifier and also kind of a political divider. And I think that's kind of unfortunate.
Of course, you talk about guns, gun rights, gun proponents, NRA comes to mind. There's also the Gun Owners of America, Second Amendment Foundation, and other organizations. What has been their greater empowerment? Has it been the politician or the courts?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. So I think that the groups you're talking about, the NRA in particular, you know, over time kind of made it a project to basically identify in the Second Amendment an individual right to have a gun for purposes other than just the well-regulated militia, which is what the amendment says. And in doing that, you know, that was sort of a decades-long project to kind of get the courts to adopt that point of view, which they eventually succeeded in doing with the Heller decision by the Supreme Court in 2008. And so I think that one kind of led to the other. I mean, I think that gun rights organizations, you know, really made the concerted effort beginning in the 1970s to sort of, you know, conduct a long game of achieving that, and using politicians, using the courts to do it, and they've succeeded probably better than they ever thought they would.
Dr. Mike McIntyre, investigative journalist for the New York Times. His new book, Ricochet, Guns, Greed, and the American Way of Violence, MikeMcIntyre.com, the website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. We can go through the various tallies, and I used to have John Lott on the show, and talking about mass shootings with him became a headbutting situation because his grand idea was to lower the number of mass shootings in America, change the definition of a mass shooting, make it require more people to qualify as opposed to staying where it is. But how does the gun lobby, how does the NRA, although they fall on hard times, mainly self-inflicted, but how does the gun lobby survive the reality of the world that they are playing a significant role in creating?
It's one of the kind of, you know, bigger head scratchers. If you think about mass shootings that have happened that are particularly bad and noteworthy, and every time it does happen, you expect afterwards something will change, and it rarely does. And I think a lot of it is just a testament to the power of the gun lobby. I mean, Sandy Hook is a good example, right? So in 2012, you had the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, 26 children and adults killed. There was automatically a big push in Congress to do something. Bills were introduced to ban, you know, what people might consider assault weapons, also to impose universal background checks. And the NRA really kicked into high gear and, you know, used their clout to make sure that none of that stuff ever came to pass. I think, as you mentioned, the NRA since then has kind of have waned a bit in their power and influence. A lot of it was sort of for internal reasons. But, you know, other groups have since kind of come to the fore, and there are other more almost extreme groups now, which are the ones taking the lead on litigation to try to knock down gun laws and continue to kind of roll the culture forward in ways that the NRA used to do, but I think has kind of ceded that position to other more aggressive groups.
And I think that's the mistake a lot of people make, too, when they're looking at the gun lobby. They think now it's down to the Proud Boys and the Promise Keepers, these rough around the edges, beer drinking, let's go play soldier in the woods and try to kidnap the Michigan governor. They're a lot smarter than we give them credit for.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, the groups that I'm thinking of who are the ones leading, like, for instance, spearheading litigation and stuff, the Firearms Policy Coalition is
right.
One, which is relatively new. Gun Owners of America, they've been around a while, but they've also been, they kind of brand themselves as a, you know, no compromise group. And I think no compromise is a pretty good way to describe a lot of what you see in the gun rights movement today. I mean, they really have kind of adopted a pretty, you know, black and white view of what gun rights should be. And they're getting a lot of help, I should say, from the Trump administration this time around. Not so much the first time in 2016, but, you know, we're seeing now the federal government filing lawsuits against states to overturn gun bans, and that's unprecedented.
And even silencer bans. It's shocking the reaching they're trying to do. And this all, and as we go to the midterms, although I've noticed it, maybe I'm not paying enough attention, I don't see as many politicians boasting about their NRA ratings or any gun group ratings as they have in the past. But when you think about that, what does a politician have to do to get that high rating from the NRA or Second Amendment Foundation or Gun Owners of America? It certainly isn't something to protect people. It's more to protect the cause.
Well, traditionally, the NRA ratings, you know, would go to politicians that basically moved in lockstep with whatever the NRA's preferred policy prescriptions are. I think one of the reasons you probably don't see too much of it today is, ironically, I mean, they've gotten a lot of what they were looking for, and it just is not like a front burner political issue on a regular basis, unless and until, tragically, something bad happens that catches everybody's attention. But in the absence of that, you don't see it sort of on a, you know, being an issue talked about, because there seem to be so many other things capturing people's attention at any given moment. I think that's one of the frustrating things for the, you know, gun safety, gun violence prevention groups, is to try to capture sustained attention to the issue, because in the absence of a particularly bad mass shooting or something that happens that, you know, demands a big media response, you just don't sort of see much, you know, concerted attention being paid to sort of the daily trickle of bloodshed that comes in. Roughly 40,000 people a year are killed by guns, half of them suicides in the United States.
So, I credit you with your book as far as explaining why and through the roots of that why. But with those roots being so deeply entrenched in history and utilized in not the ways they were intended to be utilized, what's one of the main ways that all that we're seeing today can actually be addressed if we get the promises, along with the thoughts and prayers, of course, whenever a tragedy happens? But what are those seeking solutions up against, and how can they best overcome it?
One of the things I do talk about in the book is that for, you know, gun violence prevention groups that are looking for some strategy going forward, I think that, interestingly, they could look to the NRA itself as sort of a model. The NRA, you know, as I mentioned earlier, was sort of in the 1970s really set out a long-term agenda, and it was really their goal was a generational change that would pretty much take that length of time to achieve. But they did it, and they did it through, you know, sort of inculcating in the legal community, you know, a different view of what gun rights is about, a different view of the Second Amendment. They really worked to kind of change the culture around guns, and the industry itself is also involved in that. But that took a long time. That took decades. And, you know, the seeds they planted in the 1980s, for instance, by supporting scholarship and books and law reviews and court cases, sort of espousing a certain view of gun rights, came to fruition in, you know, the subsequent Supreme Court decisions, starting with Heller in 2008. There's nothing, I think, preventing gun rights or, you know, gun safety groups kind of like, you know, it's attempting something similar but pointed in the other direction. But it's not something that's going to happen overnight.
No, without a doubt. And again, for you listening, we know the what's. They're blatant. They're obvious. What is happening as far as guns in America, hows and whys are what will lead to solutions and actions. And that's what Mike does with his book, Ricochet, Guns, Greed, and the American Way of Violence. Check out Mike's work at MikeMcIntyre.com as well as at NYTimes.com. Mike, thank you for supplying those seeking solutions with the understanding and the empowerment. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you.